Okay, we begin here with the Mishnah on Chav Hei Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says, "A Makdish Sadeu Bishata Yovel." Someone who is Makdish is Ste Achuza. Now, the Bishata Yovel, as Rashi notes over here, doesn't mean in the Yovel itself, but rather, Bizman Sho Yovel Nohek. It's a time when the Yovel is being practiced, when they are counting the Yovel and there is a Yovel around. Aval Bizman Shein Yovel Nohek. If there is no Yovel, Nohek, Podel Ta Bishovya Kishar Hek Deshot. Then you redeem it at its true value, like any other piece of Hekdesh. So the special dispensation that you have for a Stei Achuza, which we have been discussing until now, and the Psukim tell us, in Mistei Achuzato Yagdish Ish LaHashem, Vayer Kechali Fi Zaro, Zera, Chomer Seorim, V'chamishim Shekel Kesef. That's true of a Stei Achuza, first of all, only. And number two is, it's only when the Yovel is being practiced. That's the case. If not, then you have to redeem it at its full value. So there you take Notain, the Zera Chomer Seorim, for an area that can plant a Chomer of Seorim, you pay 50 Shekel Kesef. You pay 50 Shekel Kesef, just as we've spoken many times here and in Bechorot, that the word Shekel is the Shekel Min HaTorah, which is equivalent to the Sela of the Mishnah, which is equal to 4 Dinarim. And so you pay 50 Sela or 50 Shekel Kesef for an area that can support the seeding of a chomer. A chomer is synonymous with the word kur, and we find that in Yechezkel, and we saw in the Gemara that the Gemara discussed those measurements and how it knows that a kur and a chomer are of equal value. A kur is worth 30 sa'ah, and so over here you're talking about an area that can plant 30 sa'ah worth of seeds. The seeds are seeds of se'orim, of barley, which are smaller seeds than wheat seeds, which makes it a little hard to really calculate the totality of the number over here, because we know that a Beit Sa'ah is an area in which you can plant a Sa'ah worth of grain. But over there, the grain is wheat. Despite that fact, the Rambam uses that calculation and then expands to here. He says, well, if an area of 50 Amot by 50 Amot is called a Beit Sa'ah, where you can plant Sa'ah worth of seeds from seeds of wheat, then if we take that and multiply it out, and we're talking about a kur, which is 30 sa'ah, so an area of 50 by 50 is 2,500 square amot, and if then I'm dealing with 30 sa'ah, so 30 times 2,500 is 75,000 square amot, and so that means it's an area that's roughly, if you take the square root of 75,000, it's roughly 247 by 247 amot. So that's true. Again, there's some difference because here we're talking about seorim, we're talking about barley. Over there we're talking about wheat. But nevertheless, it gives you a sense of the magnitude or the size that we're discussing over here. So any field that measures to that size, you're going to pay 50 shekel for. And we'll see in the Gemara, if it's less than that size, then on a pro rata basis, you're going to pay the value of 50 shekel vis-a-vis the actual area that's there in relationship to a zerach omer seorim. Hayusham nikaim amukim. If there are crevices or depressions in the land, asarat fachim. If they have a depth of 10 fachim, oslaim gvohim. Or you have these rocks or bedrock that has a height of the asarat fachim, einan nimdadim ima. They do not get counted along with the field. Now, as Rashi says over here, ein nimdadim ima means vein niftim bishofiyam. And then you have to redeem them at their true value, which is that they don't get this special dispensation of a Beit Zerah Chomer Seorim. They're treated separately, and you have to redeem them at their full value. That's not clear that everybody agrees to that point. We'll discuss it again when we get to the Gemara, and the Gemara discusses this. But there is a machloket amongst the Rishonim as to what happens to these areas that are segregated or separate, as to whether there's one of three possibilities. Either they get counted on their own, but at the same payment schedule as we have here, which is that you pay the 50 shekel for a Beit Zerah Chomer Seorim, or it could be, like Rashi says over here, you pay their true value, the redemptive value, or it could be that they're not Hekdesh at all. Those are the three possibilities as to what it could be, and the Rishonim discuss all three of those possibilities, and we'll discuss it again when we get to the Gemara. We'll point out the different possibilities that you can, or conclusions that you can come to. The Mishnah continues and says, Pachot mikan, if it's less than that, nimdadim ima, then they're counted along with the field, meaning that they're considered a part of the area of the field. We have a similar concept in the Gemaras, both in Baba Batra, also in Eruvin, when you're trying to count areas for the 2,000 amot, these issues come up when you have land that is not exactly flat or smooth. What do you do with the ups and downs of the land? Hikdisha, shtayim v'shalosh shanim lifnei ha-yovel. We quoted this yesterday in the Gemara. If you are makdisha 2 or 3 years before the yovel, notain sela upundion l'shana. You pay a sela, which is the equivalent of a shekel, upundion l'shana, and an additional pundion, which is 1/48 of a sela, 1/48 of a shekel, per each year that remains until the yovel. And we discussed this already yesterday. It's 50 divided by 49. If you take that, then each sela for each year makes it 49 sela. And then if you have pundion for each year, then you get 49 pundion. 48 of those will equal another sela, gets you to the 50. And then you have an additional pundion, which you use for the kulbon, which again is either to make up the deficit in the coins for not being perfect, or it's to pay for the money changing to the exchanger of the coins. V'imamar, harini notain davar shana bishana. If he says, you know what, I'll pay it on an installment basis. I'll pay you each year, I'll pay you a sela and pundion. Ein shomim lo. He doesn't have a right to do that. Ela notain et kulo keachad. He's got to give it all in one shot. He's got to give a lump sum payment now to redeem the field for whatever remains until the yovel. He can't pay it off over the years until the yovel. Now, he does have the possibility, which we'll see later in the Masechta, of maybe redeeming a portion of the assets rather than all of the assets. But if he wants to redeem all the assets and he can't afford it, he can't pay on an installment basis. He has to pay the whole sum up front. So it may pay to break up the fields and redeem portions of the field if that possibility exists, as we'll see in the Gemara later on. Echad balim v'echad kol adam. Doesn't matter who redeems the field, whether it's the owner of the field, the one who was makdishit, or whether it's a third party. Ma ben balim the kol adam. So is there any difference between the owners redeeming it and a third party redeeming it? Ella, shebalim notnim chomesh. The balim have to add on in their redemption an additional fifth. A fifth, the way that the Gemara says it, is milabar, which really means an additional 25%. V'chol adam eid notnim lo chomesh. The other people, a third party, doesn't have to add on a chomesh. So that means that for a third party that's redeeming it, they'll pay a sela umpundion per year left until the yovel. And for the balim, they're going to pay 1 1/4 sela and 1 1/4 pundion for every year that remains until the yovel. And that's based on the pasuk in Perek Chav Zayin in Vayikra, pasuk Yutet, Vim Gaol Yigal et asadeh hamakdish oto, the person was makdishit, ve'yasaf chamishit kesef erkecha alav v'kam lo. So he has to add on an additional fifth on top of the redemption value in order to redeem it. Now the Gemara says, Tana, kur zera v'lo kur tvua. I said this because it seems obvious from the Torah, because the Torah classifies the field as being a zera chomer se'orim. But the Gemara makes it clear here that when we're speaking about a kur, we're speaking about a field that has an area that you would seed with a kur 30 sa'ah worth of seeds, not an area of a field that would produce 30 sa'ah of tvuah. Obviously, that's in favor of the person that's being makdish the field, because you obviously need a much larger area to seed 30 sa'ah than you do to produce 30 sa'ah worth of grain. So that means that we are looking at a much larger area. The density of the seeds that grow in the tvuah would make it that if you're looking at the productive quality of the field, then it would be a much smaller area. In addition to the fact that we have already said that there is no differential in the valuation of different fields, whether they're in the best fields of Sebastia or whether they're from the Trashim of the mountains, doesn't matter, they all have the same redemptive value. If the productive quality of the land mattered, then it actually would be a difference between them. And so then that doesn't make sense. So it must be that we're talking about the seeding, as well as the fact that the pasuk says zera chomer se'orim. Now, mapolet yad velo mapolet shvarim. The seeding is a hand seeding and not a more mechanical type of seeding, which today we have mechanical seeders that do this. This is a primitive form of a mechanical seeder, which Rashi describes over here, that they used to take a bag full of seeds. They used to cut a little hole in it, and then they'd put it on the back of the plow, and then whether they allowed it to fall through the blade of the plow or whether they just let it fall off the back of the plow, they'd start moving, and then the seeds would fall out of the bag. Now, you don't have so much control over that, and so, as the Rabbeinu Gershom says, sometimes you get more seeds coming out. You don't control the pace of the seeds, but it seems that the density, again, of the seeding would be much tighter if you did it by mechanical means or by doing it on the back of the plow, rather than doing it by hand. By hand, you'd spread it out in a more even fashion. And so because of that, you would end up with an area that is larger. So again, this is in favor of the Makdish, because the area that we count that he has to pay the 50 shekel for is a much larger swath of land, because we're talking about hand seating and not mechanical seating. Tani Levi, lo meuveh. So now, when we're looking at this, it's not where it's very thick, quote-unquote, lo meidak, and not very thin, ela beinoni, but in the middle ground. As Rashi describes over here, the Rabbeinu Gershom says the same thing, which is that meuveh means that when you put a lot of seeds in a concentrated area, and meidak means when you put very little seed in an area, you're sparse with your seeding. Rashi actually calls it clear. So it's, I guess, means that it's not so visible. You can't see them because they're spread out. So what Tana de Levi says, the Braita from Levi says, is that we're not talking about where you're planting and seeding in a very dense manner. It's also not when you're seeding in a very scattered manner. It's a benoni. It's a middle of the road type of seeding. It's a standard type of seeding. And that's the determination of the area that we're going to count for a Beit Zera Chomer Se'orim, which is an area that you seed in a normal fashion that is hand seeded. That is the area that would take to plant normally a core worth of zera se'orim. Ayusham nikaim amukim. Where it says, v'lekadshu ban pei nafshayu. Over here, the Mishnah indicates to us that they're either counted with it or not counted with it. So even if you say that they are separated away and they're not part of the greater field, they should still at least have some value that's associated with hekdesh. And the assumption would be here, is that they'd be treated the same way that the fields are treated, which is you'd calculate the Beit Zera Chomer Se'orim, and you'd figure out the proper redemption rate. So what are you going to suggest, that you have to meet the minimum threshold of a Beit Kor, and if you're smaller than a Beit Kor, you don't get this special dispensation to redeem it at a fixed value? Vatanya, Sadeh. The Pasuk says Sadeh, which was unnecessary. It says Imiste Achuzato. And it could have just said, v'im me'achuzato. Why does it use the word sedeh over here? So the Gemara says, t'ma tamalomar, l'fish nemar zere chomer seorim v'chamishim shekel keset. En eli shehigdish kinyan hazeh. You would thought only if he reaches that threshold of size, then you would have this special dispensation to redeem it at 50 shekel. Minayin the rabot letech. Letech is half a kor, or 15 sa'ah. Chetz e letech is a quarter of a kor, or 7.5 sa'a. Sa'a, obviously, is a sa'a. Tarkav is made up of two words, according to many of the Rishonim, trey, and then kav, which means three kav. Or, in essence, it is half a sa'a, because a sa'a is six kav. So, trey kav, three kav would be half a sa'a. Others say it comes from the word tri kav, three kav. Vechatzi tarkav, or half a tarkav, which would be 1.5 kav, or a quarter of a sa'ah. How do I know that even if you have any of those other sizes of land, that you still have to redeem it at this fixed rate? Tamalomar, sadeh, mikol makom. The sadeh tells you no matter what field it is, doesn't have to meet the minimum standard, any sadeh is subject to this din when it's a stay achuza. Amar mar ukva bar chamo. Hocha, the story in our Mishnah is, b'nikaim mle'im ma'im. The crevices or the depressions are full of water. Because they're not plantable areas. So if they're not plantable areas, they can't be subject to the din of Beit Zera Chomer Se'orim, because they can't be seeded, they can't be planted. The Gemara says, dekanami, it's mduyak out of the Mishnah that makes sense. Diktani dumya dislaim. The comparison between the crevices or the depressions in the land were contrasted with the peaks of the land, the bedrock of the land. Now, it's clear that the bedrock of the land is not plantable area, and so what we're suggesting here is also the depressions or the crevices also must be areas that are not plantable. Shma mina, so that's what we see from here, that they are not included, number one, because of the depth or the height, so they are separated away from the land, but they also do not attain independent hekdesh because they're not plantable areas. And since they are not plantable areas, they do not have a din of hekdesh. Now, again, what happens to these areas? Either you say that those areas are separate, and you have to redeem them at their real, true value. You have to assess them at their true value. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that they are mukdash. But the Torah tells us that they're subsumed. When you have a field like this, when you redeem the bigger field, these items get released, even though you've never really redeemed them, just because they are contained within the field. Or some people suggest that they are independent entities, and since they're not a Beit Zriah, they're not included in your Hekdesh of a Stei Achuzah. So again, here you have the three possibilities as to what that means, that these are not a Beit Zriah, Bnei Zriah, they're not a plantable area. So what is their status? One possibility is that they're Kodesh, and you need to redeem them at their full value. The other one is they're Kodesh. The Gzeret HaKatuv is that they get released with the remainder of the field, even though you don't redeem them at any value. Or the possibility is that they're not Hekdesh at all, because they're not subsumed in the field, they're considered to be independent entities. And you're makdish the sadeh, you met the sadeh, but not these items. Now the Gemara says, Iochi pachot mikanami. If that's the case, then why do you need that threshold of 10 tefachim? 10 tefachim is what separated them away from the land. If they're full of water, then even at less than 10 tefachim, why are they not also considered to be separate areas from the land? First of all, they're not plantable, and also they are distinct from the remainder of the land. The Gemara says, because hanu nagane da'ara mikru, shidre da'ara mikru. Those are called the clefts of the earth, or the spine of the earth. As Rashi says, by an animal, the spine or the back of the animal is the highest point. So when you have bedrock that's running along the land, it looks like a spine or back that is running along the land, and the crevices are like clefts in the cleft. And therefore, they are considered to be the natural ups and downs of the land. No land is absolutely flat. And therefore, if they're less than 10 tefachim, they are batel, in some sense, to the land itself. If they're batel to the land itself, then they are incorporated in the calculation of the area of the land. The only thing we didn't discuss is what happens if you have depressions that are more than 10 tefachim, or elevations that are more than 10 tefachim, but don't have water in them, or are not bedrock, and they are plantable land. So in that case, what happens to those areas? So thing that would make the most sense is that they become kadosh, like the field itself, but they are independent of the field. So you have to redeem them separately from the field itself, but at the same rate of the 50 shekel for a Beit Zerah Chomer Se'orim. So they would have the same rate of redemption. They would just be considered separate fields, which might help you in terms of redeeming portions of the field or not having to redeem the whole thing because they're considered to be separate areas. That's one possibility as to what happens if they are plantable and there's no water in them. There are others who say then they're measured at their underlying value, their true value, because they're independent of the field, but they themselves are not significant enough to be considered or classified as a field. Or there's a possibility that maybe they're counted with the field itself. Maybe they're subsumed in the field itself because they are plantable areas and they are not considered to be independent. Even though they have 10 tefachim high or 10 tefachim low, they're still the same character of the land. And since they're plantable, they'll be included in the total calculation of the field. So that's the three different ways to deal with them. So again, we here dealt with all these different possibilities. And in each case, the Rishonim argue about what is the status of the item when it's classified as independent of the field. Both in the situation where there's water in there and it's more than 10 tefachim, which makes it independent and not plantable. And also in the case where it's 10 tefachim without water in it and is plantable. Again, there we had the similar slew of Rishonim that discuss what exactly the status of that area is. And again, in each of these cases, there is somebody who believes that they get redeemed Bishuv Yam at their actual value. There is somebody who believes that they get calculated separately at the 50 shekel of Beit Zerah Chomer Se'orim. And there's somebody who says that they're included in the field itself. And that will reflect itself also in the areas when there's water in there and they're not plantable. Either they get separately assessed at their true value, or they are subsumed in the field to the point where when you redeem the field, they get taken out as well, even though you're not assigning any value to them. Or the possibility that they're not kadosh at all because they're independent entities. So now the Gemara says, Hekdesha shtayim shloshanim lifnei yovel. Tanu Rabbanan. The pasuk says by the Stei Achuzah that if imachar yovel yakdish sedeu, v'chishev lo et hakohen et hakesef al pi hashanim hatorot ad shnat hayovel v'nigra me'erkecha. And then you reduce the amount that you pay. Af min hakedesh. Then, when it says, minigrami erkecha, that you reduce the price, that's even from Hekdesh. Shimachla, Hekdesh, Shana, Oshtaim. If Hekdesh ate it for 1 or 2 years, inami, loachla, or it didn't eat it, El Shaita Lefanav, where it was just sitting there, Notain Selo Pundion Lishana. So what the Gemara is describing over here is what happens when he's Makdish the Steach Uzah, and it's in the hands of the Gizbar. And then over the next 2 or 3 years, the Gizbar either plants it, utilizes it, and harvests it, and garners the produce of the field, or maybe the Gizbar does nothing with it. It just sits in the hands of Hekdesh without the Gizbar doing anything with it, despite the fact that Hekdesh got nothing from it. Or despite the fact that Hekdesh was eating from it, that benefit accrues to the Baalim, and therefore they will now, when they go to redeem it, be able to deduct those years from the amount that they have to redeem. And now it will pay 2 or 3 years less in value because that time has elapsed at the point that he's coming to redeem it. And so the years count, whether they are being utilized by Hekdesh, whether they're sitting idle, as long as the years elapse, then you get a reduction in the amount that you have to pay in order to redeem it. Imamar Harini Notain, he says, I'm going to pay in installments. Tanrabanan, we have a bright. I mean, Nain Shimamru Balim, Harini Notnim, Davar Shana Bishana. I'm going to pay on a yearly basis. I'll pay the Selum Pundion each year. Shain Shomim Lahem. How do we know we don't listen to them? Tamalomar, it says in the Pasu, which we just read before, Vichishab Lo Akoin et Akesef, Al Pi Hashanim Anotarot. So there's a cheshbon that is done based on the kesef that he owes, Ache Kesef Kulo Kechad, until he pays the whole sum that he owes. Echad Balim, Vechad Kol Adam, doesn't matter whether it's the owners or anybody else, the same rules apply to everyone, in terms of reduction of price that you have to pay in order to redeem it. Ma Ben Balim L'Kol Adam, what's the only difference between the Balim and anyone else? Is Balim Notim Chomesh, the Balim add on an extra 25%. Kol Adam Ein Notim Chomesh, any other third party would not add on 25%. Now this part of the Gemara is very strange, because the Gemara is quoting the Mishnah, but doesn't give an explication on it, just quotes the Mishnah without doing anything. And that likely is because the next Mishnah is really a continuation of what's the difference between the Baalim and the third party. And so what it's doing now is giving this introductory phase, basically connecting the previous Mishnah of Ma Ben Baalim L'Chol Adam, and saying that this subsequent Mishnah is a continuation. These two halachot, the one that we just read in the Gemara that has no explication on it, and the subsequent halacha that's coming up in this Mishnah, are both about the differences between the Baalim and third parties, which is Hikdisha Vigala. If he, the Baalim, were Makdishit, and then they themselves redeemed the field from Hekdesh, Inu Yatzam Biyado Biyovel. Then in the Yovel, it stays with the original owner, because he's redeemed it, and it's in his possession, and to his Steachuzah, so it remains with him. Ga'ala Bino. If his son redeemed it, not he, Yotzal Aviv Biyovel. Then when the Yovel comes, the son is considered to be a leaseholder in the property, and then the property goes back to the father when the Yovel comes about. Gala acher o echad min akrovim. If a third party redeemed it, or any one of the other relatives, v'ga'ala miyodo, and then the original owner buys it off of this third party, or any of his other relatives, yotzala kohanim biyovel. Then it goes out to the kohanim in the yovel. So that's the girsa that we have in our Mishnah, which is that if a third party redeems it, then the pasuk tells us, v'im lo igale tasadeh, if he never redeems the field, v'machar tasadeh li'ishacher, and then the gizbar sells it off to a third party, lo igael od. There's no more redeeming the property. The property then remains as technically Hekdesh's property, and whoever is the redeeming person is really buying a leasehold in the property until the yovel. And that means whatever he has, he can sell to the original owner. He doesn't have ownership. He's selling the leasehold. So when he sells it to the original owner, that's all he's selling is the leasehold. But then when the Yovel comes around, the Pasuk says, Vayasa David Setobi Yovel Kodesh Lashem, Kesteacherim Lakoin Tiachuzato. Then it goes to the Kohanim. The way that it works is that the Mishmar that is working in that period of time when the Yovel happens, they get all the land that belongs to Hekdesh that was redeemed by third parties. It's released to them at that point in time in the Yovel. That's the Girsa that we have. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, it's the last line in the Rabbeinu Gershom, or if you look up a Mishnah, you open up a Kahati, any Mishnah, you open it up, the Girsata Mishnah is similar to what the Rabbeinu Gershom has over here, which is Ga'ala Acher, O Echad Min HaKrovim. If a third party redeemed it, or any other relative redeemed it, V'chazar Zev V'amakdish, and then the person who was the original owner, the Makdish, goes ahead, V'ga'alam Yado, buys it back from them, then Eina yotza miyado biyovel. Then he gets to keep it when the Yovel comes around. So obviously this is a huge nafkamina in the Girsaot as to what happens over here. The way that we have it in our Mishnah is that the Torah's prescription, which is that once it's sold to a third party, lo yigael ot. There's no right or there's no ability to redeem it anymore. If that's the case, the owner has lost possibility of recouping that land. And then anybody who has the land now is just a leaseholder in it. And if he buys it, all he is replacing them as the leaseholder. And that's why, when it comes to the Ovel, it's going to be distributed to the Kohanim. On the other hand, according to the Girsa of the Rabbeinu Gershom, once he buys it back from the third party that redeemed it, he basically returns it to its original state. He's able then to, instead of him redeeming it directly from Hekdesh, he just redeemed it through a third party, and now he is replicating the effect of him redeeming it from Hekdesh, which brings it back into his possession. And so he can basically create a reset, whereby he is now back to being the owner of the property, and it won't go out to the Kohanim in the Ovel. And that's the two different Girsaot, and that's the machloket between them as to how we view the intermediary party that has redeemed it when he goes to redeem it from them. Do they then change the dynamic to the point where lo yigael ot, and he can't do anything about it? Or are they simply just, in a sense, acting as his proxy? They bought it from Hekdesh almost on his behalf, because in the end, he buys it from them. And in buying it from them, he basically made them a proxy to buy it from Hekdesh, even though he wasn't around, and when they did it, he wasn't really instructing them. But we look at it effectively in that way, and it's as if he now is back to being the owner of the property, and he will keep it once the Yovel comes around. The other possibilities of what happens over here are the possibility that a third party redeems it, and the original owner never comes and redeems it from that party. In that case, the land in the Yovel will be distributed to the Kohanim. The other possibility is that nobody redeems it, and it remains in the hands of Hekdesh all the way until the Yovel. In that case, as well, it'll be distributed to the Kohanim of the Mishmar of that Yovel. And we'll see in a second there's a Tano that does not believe that that's the case, that disagrees with that. But there's also a Machloket Tanaim, which we saw in yesterday's daf at the bottom of the Amud Aleph. There's a Machloket as to where in that case the Kohanim have to pay for it and redeem it when it comes to them, when there was no other intermediary party that redeemed it, because Hekdesh never received any money for it. And Hekdesh is not allowed to go out without being redeemed. We'll see in a second, Machloket, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, as to whether the Kohanim have to pay to release the property in that case. But here we have another interesting case, which is Gala Achad Min HaKohanim. The third party that came and redeemed it was a Kohen. So now, if it was a regular Yisrael that came and redeemed the property, then when the Yovel comes around, it would be released to the Kohanim of the Mishmar at the time of the Yovel. That's what we'd explained before, that if it's a third party and the original owner never comes to intervene, then he has a leasehold on the property till the Yovel, and then when the Yovel comes, it's distributed to the Kohanim. But over here, the third party was a Kohen, and he'll say the following thing. He'll say, V'hari tachet yado, it's under his possession. Lo yomar, he can't say, Olovi yotza l'Kohanim b'Yovel, since it's going to be distributed to the Kohanim anyway on the Yovel, V'hari tachet yadi, and I already have it, harihi shali, so then maybe I should just keep it. Ella, that's not what happens. Yotza mitachet yado, umitkalechet d'kolechav v'Kohanim. But rather, it is distributed, or it's released from him, or taken away from him, and given to all of the Kohanim. Now, it really depends about the status of this Kohen. If this Kohen is from a different Mishmar, then he would get nothing of the field, and be distributed to the Kohanim of the Mishmar on the time of the Ovel. In all likelihood, we're speaking about here a Kohen who's part of the Mishmar. And that's why he thinks that, listen, if it was being distributed, I would get it anyway when it's being distributed. There's nobody better than me. I already own it, so I should just keep the whole thing. And the mission says you don't do that because it belongs to the Mishmar as a whole, the class of the Mishmar as a whole, and therefore you can't just keep it for yourself. You have to go and release it to the Mishmar on the Yovel, and you'll get your pro rata piece of the land. You can't keep the whole thing for yourself. Right, so now the Gemara says, Tanrabanan, im lo yigal et hasadeh, if the field was not redeemed, that refers to the Baalim, the owners. Ve'im macharta sedeh the ish acher. So if the field is sold by the gizbar, the ish acher, to someone else, la acher velo the ben. That's someone else and not the son. Ata omer la acher velo the ben. Oenu ela la acher velo the ach. How do I know who that relative is that's not considered to be an acher? Over here it says when you sell it to a third party, some other party. That means that there is a party that's not considered to be an other. Sometimes you could sell it to a party that's considered to be the same or beneficial to the owner itself. So the Braita proposed that it was the Ben. And now it backs up and says, how do you know it's the ben? Maybe it's the brother. How do I know who's closer in terms of relationship, the son or the brother, in terms of stepping into the shoes of this individual? Kishu Omer, ish, when it says the ish acher, that is hare ach amur. That tells you that it's a brother. So a brother is considered to be like a third party. Ha mani mikayem acher velo ben. That means that the only way to explain acher means another party besides the son. And now the Gemara asks the obvious question, the Braita asks the obvious question, umareita, the rabota da ben, ulotziat ach. Why would you include the son and exclude the brother? We made an assumption that the word ish means including the brother as a third party, and acher is excluding the son as a third party, that he's considered to be not a third party. You could have easily just said the other way around. You could have said ish means the son is considered a third party, and acher is there considered to be third parties, but not the ach, who's not considered to be a third party. You could have switched them around. So the Gemara says, Mirabe ani haben, sheken kam tachet aviv, the son is steps into the shoes of the father, because he stands in for the father, li'yida, u'le'evid ivri, by these two halachot. One is Yehud. Yehud is a halacha that's associated with an ama ha'ivriya, an individual, an adon, a master that buys an ama ha'ivriya to work for him. She will go free once she comes of age. But the optimal way the Torah views the purchase of the ama ha'ivriya is that he purchases her, but then actually marries her. That marriage is called Yehada. And that is, he can use the monies of the purchase to act as the kesef kiddushim, and therefore he can marry her. Now, in marrying her, he has two choices. He can either marry her himself, or he can offer the son the opportunity to marry this ama ivriya. And in both cases, the kesef, the money that was used to purchase her from her father, would be the kesef kiddushim. So you see over here that either a father or a son can perform yehud. That means that the son is the one who can step into his father's shoes to marry the ama ivriya. In addition, Eved Ivri, if the master passes away, he is released. He's not considered to be property of the owner. Unlike an Eved Knani, who's considered to be the property of the owner, and therefore if he passes away, the Yorshim, the inheritors, also inherit the Eved Knani. That's not true by an Eved Ivri. An Eved Ivri is working for that particular master. If that master passes away, he is then released from his avdut, with the exception of a son. If it is a son that's inheriting, then the Eved Ivri continues to work for the son and is not released from his avdut. So once again, you see the son stepping into the shoes of the father. It says, Adrabo. Maybe you could say the opposite. Wait, maybe the brother is a closer relative, because the brother would step into the shoes of his brother when there are no children, when there's Yibum to be performed. So he becomes his brother in the case of Yibum and marries his wife. The Gemara answers, Klum yesh Yibum, elav makom shein ben. Yibum is only relevant when you don't have a child. Hayesh bein, ein Yibum. If there is a child there, then there is no Yibum. Which basically shows you, tells what says, not that they're equal, a ben and a brother, but that the ben supersedes the brother. Because if there is a child there, the brother's ability to act or have Yibum is totally negated. So the son is the closer relative in this case. Gemara says, why do you have to come to that reasoning? You typically just say that the reason that you pick the child as being the closer relative than the brother is because the hachatarte, by the child you have two places where he steps into the shoes of his father, one by Yehud and one by Eved Ivri, as opposed to the brother, Bachachado, where the brother only has one place where he steps into the shoes of the brother, and that's in Yibum. So why don't you just say that? Forget about this whole logic by the Yibum, that the son stops the brother from performing Yibum. Even without that, you have two places where the son steps into the father's shoes, and only one place where the brother steps into his brother's shoes. So Gemara says, Vishum Devid Ivri, Mahai Pircha, Namihu Denafkale. The reason that Eved Ivri goes to the son and not the brother is for the same logic of Klum Yesh Yibum, Elo Makom Shein Bein. Because, is there really any Yibum when there's no son? Now, if you go to the Gemara in Kiddushin that discusses this, there the Gemara says, how do I know, when it comes to Eved Ivri, that he is released when it is going to a third party, and that he is staying with the son when it's the son that's inheriting the father? Maybe you could say it's the brother. Who says that the son is the closest relative, and therefore he steps into the shoes of the father? Maybe it should be the brother that steps into the shoes of the brother, and he should be the one, if he inherits, to be the one to keep the Eved Ivri. But if it went to the son, maybe he shouldn't be able to keep it. So there the Gemara says, well, you can't say that because the son steps into the shoes of his father in two areas. One is Le'yehud, and the other one is Ste'achuza, which is our Gemara right here. So it's Yehud and Ste'achuza. Where it says Adarabba there in the Gemara in Kedushin, but the brother steps into the shoes of his brother for Yibum. So then again, you have two things for the son and one thing for the brother. But if you take note, there's circular logic going on. Because by the son, Yehud is something where we know in the Torah, it says explicitly that he steps into his father's shoes and he can perform Yehud if the father does not want to perform Yehud. But with regards to the case of Eved Ivri, the Gemara says, well, how do we know the son steps into the shoes of the father? That's because of Yehud and Ste'achuza, which is our case over here. And the case over here says, you know how I know the son steps into the shoes of his father? It's because of Yehud and Eved Ivri. So now when I'm talking about Ste'achuza, I say, oh, Eved Ivri is my proof. And then when I'm talking about Eved Ivri, I say, Ste'achuza is my proof. That makes it into a circular logic. And that means that the truth is that Eved Ivri and Ste'achuza are not machri at all. Because they are learnt one from the other, but they're only learnt once we know that the son takes priority over the brother. So now we're left with really two things that are faced off against each other. Yehud, where the son is the primary person that steps into his father's shoes, and Yibum, where the brother is the one who steps into his brother's shoes. So it's one against one. How do I know which trumps? That's the logic that we stated over here. Klum yesh Yibum b'makom haben. There's no Yibum when there's a son there. And though basically the son negates the Yibum, and that's why he is considered to be the true inheritor of the father. He's the one who steps into his shoes. And therefore, the din is by Eved Ivri and Ste'achuza that we say that the son also trumps the brother because we already established through that logic of Klum, Yeshibum, B'makom HaBen, that's what establishes that the son is the one that takes priority. Once we've already established that, then we know that Eved Ivri and then we know that Ste'achuza are also the son. But they can't be counted in the weighing between the son and the brother because they're only a result of the limud. They themselves, we don't have a source for the fact that there the son takes precedence. Now, bai rabba baravua, bat maush tamid sadeh laviha. When a daughter redeems the land, what does that do in terms of returning the land to her father, to the original owner? The son that redeems the field, then at the yovel, it goes back to the father because he's not considered to be an acher. What is the status of a bat? Is she also not considered to be a cher? She's not considered to be a third party. And therefore, if she redeemed it, then the land will return to her father in the ovel or not. So when it says, Kevin delinyan yibom, benu bat ke'adodi, patre, just like by yibom, a son and daughter are equal. It doesn't matter whether the brother had a son or the brother had a daughter, there's no yibom performed as long as there's any zeren, as long as there's any offspring that he had. So there you see that a ben and a bat are considered to be equal. Since they're equal over there, maybe over here too, they'll be equal. So mukma and the bat's redemption will also return the field to her father in the ovel. Odilma, kevin delinya nachala. When it comes to the hierarchy of inheritance, bat bat v'makom ben k'acher damya. A daughter in the face of a son is considered to be a third party. Lo mukma, then you wouldn't establish it. In terms of the hierarchy of inheritance, the son is the primary inheritor. Then the daughter is next in line if there are no sons. And then afterwards, the brother comes in. So yes, the daughter takes precedence over the brother, but she is subordinated to the son. And so since this son gets precedence in terms of inheritance, maybe that means that the daughter is considered to be a third party or independent, and therefore lo mukma, and therefore we would not return the field to the father. The Balei HaTosafot on the previous Amud asks, why didn't the Gemara also bring this as another piece of evidence that the son should trump the brother? Because over here, the son inherits the father. So Tosfot says that he doesn't think the Gemara brings items where both parties are inheritors, meaning that the son's an inheritor of the father, but so is the brother an inheritor of the father. It's true that the son goes first before the brother, which should have given us some sort of evidence, but the case is that they both inherited the father. That doesn't really demonstrate to us who is the one who really steps into the shoes of the father. We're looking for halachot where the din is true only of the ben and not of the brother at all. Or vice versa. It's only true of the brother, not of the ben. That's why we use Yibum and Yehud, and we didn't use Nachala. So the Gemara says, Tashma, the Tana debate Rabbi Shmuel, Koshu Acher b'makom haben. anybody who's considered to be a third party in the face of the sun is considered to be a third party, and therefore it would not return the field to the father in the, or the makdish in the yovel. And this daughter is considered to be a third party in the face of the son. If she's there with the son, she's subordinated to the son with regards to the nachala, and therefore she's considered to be an acher vis-a-vis the son. She's an acher vis-a-vis the son. She's also now an acher vis-a-vis the father. If that's the case, if she redeems it in the yovel, it will not return to the father, but rather it will be yotzei lekohanim shel oto mishmar. The Rabbeinu Gershom says, since the daughter in the face of the son is considered to be an acher, that means that even if this individual has no sons and his daughters will inherit him, that doesn't matter if she goes in and buys or redeems the property from Hekdesh, that won't make her a party that can return it to him in the Yovel. Since when there is a son there, she is not the primary inheritor. She's now considered to be a third party, even when there is no son that's there. And so there, in that case, if she redeemed the property, it would not go back to the father. By Rabbi Zeira, Isha mi mamid la sadeh. A woman, as she says over here, we're speaking about her nichsei malog. These are the properties that the woman brought into the marriage that she owns, that her husband is allowed to get the benefit of the peirot, the production, the leasehold of the field while they are married. So now that woman's field, if she's makdish the fields, she's the owner of the field, she can be makdish the field. She can't take away the leasehold or the peirot of the husband, but she can be makdish the field. So then, does the woman have a similar type of person like the father has in the son? We say that if it's a third party, then it hurts the father because he won't get it back in the ovel. If it's not a third party, it's a son, then he will get it back in the ovel. For the woman who's makdish her property, is there a party that's similar to the son who's not classified as a third party? So the Gemara gives two options as to who could be that party like the son. Is it Baal Mukimla Shekin Yorsha? Is it the husband that if he redeemed the property, then it would go back to her in the Ovel because he would inherit her? He's the primary inheritor of the wife. And so therefore he's considered to be the party that is not a third party. Or Ikadamre, some say Ben Mukimla. It's the son that returns it to the mother. Because the son inherits the mother in a more generous way or a more complete way than the husband. So you have here basically two parties who are inheritors of this woman. One is the husband and one is the son. So they're both inheritors. And what we're trying to figure out is who's the closer relative to be considered the one that would return the property to them in the Ovel versus being an acher, being a third party who would not return it to them in the Ovel. So one possibility, it's the husband, because he is first in line in terms of the hierarchy of inheritance. If the woman passes away, the husband gets the property even before the son gets the property. And so therefore, he's the primary inheritor. He should be the one who's considered not to be an acher. Or do we say that the son is a more powerful inheritor? He may not be first in line, but he's a more powerful inheritor. That is because the husband only inherits from the woman what assets are there at the moment that she passes away. Whatever assets exist are tangible at that time, he gets. If she has some relative that in the future passes away and would have passed inheritance to her, then the husband is not entitled to that inheritance. On the other hand, her son is entitled to that inheritance. If the son inherits her, if he doesn't, but then future properties fall and they would have gone to her had she been alive, the son steps into her shoes and inherits that property. So you see, the son has a more powerful connection to the mother in the sense that he can step into her shoes for inheritance that comes in the future. On the other hand, the Baal has a more powerful relationship in the sense that he's the first inheritor of the woman. So that's why we have two opinions here as to who can step in to be the party that, if they redeem the property, would then be Yotzei Le'Yovel to the original owner or the woman over here. And the Gemara leaves it as a teiko. That's the way that our Gemara reads, is that this is a dual question. We're not sure about Baal and we're not sure about Ben. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom over here, when we're explaining the Gemara, says by Baala, mi mamid la Baala, does the husband successful at being mamid the sadeh for her? Whereas by the son, he states it as a fact that the son can be mamid it, can return it to the mother. And the Rambam has a similar sentiment, says that the Ben, we're sure, can stand in for the mother, and if he buys the property, it would definitely go to the mother in the Yovel. The only question is, does the Baal also have that standing? And that's the nature of the Gemara's question. Is the Baal also on that standing? And that's what the Gemara leaves as a teiku. Now the Gemara says, Hikdisha pachot mishtei shanim lifnei yovel. You makdisha with less than 2 years to go to the yovel. Ma'u shetetzei the kohanim. What happens when the yovel hits in terms of going to the kohanim? So amalei madatech. Why would you think it should be any different? Well, we already know from yesterday's daf that if you're a makdishit with less than 2 years remaining till the yovel, then there's no v'nigra merkecha. We do not reduce the payment you make. You have to pay the full 50 shekel in that case. So what are you thinking? The way that the pasuk is structured makes it sound like that which goes out to the kohanim is that which is also subject to v'nigra merkecha. If you have nigra merkecha, then you also have that it goes out to the kohanim. It says, "V'machar yovel yakdish sadeu, chishav lo akoin et hakesef al pi hashanim notarot ad shnat yovel v'nigra merkecha." So then, after v'nigra merkecha, later on it says, "V'yasadeu b'tzito b'yovel kodesh l'Hashem k'steh achem l'akoin t'yachuzato." Sounds like from that that only if the field is subject to reduction in price would it then be also subject to being released to the kohanim in the yovel. And that applies here where you don't get this reduced pricing. You have to pay the full 50 shekel. Then it would not go in the yovel to the kohanim. So that, v'nigram erkecha v'yasadev tzito v'yovel, the bat giron in, the la bet giron lo. Only if it has this reduced payment where you pay by the years remaining, then it goes out to the kohanim. Absent that, it won't go to the kohanim. Says adrabo. What about the fact that there's intervening psukim over there? There's a pasuk that says, v'im goli galat asadev makdishoto v'yasef kamishit kesev erkechala v'kam lo. Then he gets to keep it. There's also a pasuk after that says, "V'im lo yigal et asadeh." If he doesn't redeem the field, "V'im achor et asadeh le'ish acher lo yigael od." So then it's not redeemed at all. And then it says there, "V'yasadeh b'tzeitu b'yovel kodesh l'Hashem k'steh achem l'kon t'yechon zato." So you have this intervening pasuk of lo yigal if it was never redeemed. So in the case where it's never redeemed, it's not subject to v'nigra be'erkecha. And despite that fact, it still goes to the kohanim in the yovel. So that shows you that your diok or whatever you're learning here is incorrect. Because im lo yigal asadeh, v'yasadeh b'tzeitu b'yovel, v'haynami bat ge'ulahi. And this field is also a field that has subject to ge'ulah. That means anything that is ra'ui le ge'ulah is subject to this din of being released to the kohanim and the yovel. And so too, if you makdishin within 2 years of the yovel, even though you have to pay a full 50 shekel, it still will be released to the kohanim on the yovel. Gala achad min ha'kohanim. One of the kohanim redeemed it. Tan Rabbanan. L'kohen tiyeh achuzato. The pen of the pasuk says that the kohen will take it as a possession. Ma tamad lomar. What is meant by that pasuk? Minayin l'sadeh sheyotzeh l'kohanim v'yovel. V'ga'ala achad min ha'kohanim. How do you know that a sadeh that is going out to the kohanim in the yovel, and one of the kohanim had redeemed it. Minayin sheyotzeh l'yomar ho v'yotzeh l'kohen. Hari tachat yadi utei sheli. How do I know that since it's going to go out to the kohen on the yovel, and I already have possession of it, maybe I should keep it. V'dinu. And it makes sense logically. Kal v'chomer. B'shel acherim ani zocheh. If it was a third party's property, I would get it in the yovel. Shel atzmi lo shekoshkein. And certainly when it's my own property, I should be able to keep it. Tamad lomar achuzato. It says in the pasuk, achuzato, achuza shelo. V'ein zeh shelo. It's only when it's his possession does he get to keep it. If it's not his possession, he doesn't get to keep it. Ha keitzad. So then what do you do in that scenario? You would say, mitachad yado, mitchaleke de'achav ha'kohanim. It's released from him back to the mishmar that is working then and distributed amongst all the kohanim of that mishmar. It doesn't stay in his personal possession. And that's because the pasuk says, v'yasadeh b'tzeito b'yovel kodesh la'ashem, k'stei acherem, la'kohen tiyeh. It could have said over here, achuza. Why does it say, la'kohen tiyeh, achuzato? So that comes to make the diuk that achuzato means it has to be achuzah shelo in order for him to retain it. On the other hand, if it's simply just a purchase or something that he got, that he redeemed, that will not remain in his possession. So the extraneous term of achuzato teaches us that limud, that it has to be owned by him and his own achuzah for it to remain in his possession. Tosfot does ask over here, without the word achuzato, what would have been the havamina of the Gemara over here? That it should remain in his possession. Where do you see such a thing that it should remain in his possession? So Tosfot, he goes to the pasuk that tells us v'ish et kodeshav lo yeh. That we learn from that pasuk that any kohen that brings up his own korbanot to the mikdash, he can process them himself, and he can garner the matnot that come from that korban for himself. So we see that there is a certain amount of freedom for the individual to function as a Kohen, independent of what the Mishmarot or Bate Avot that are going on. So maybe without the word Achuzato, I would have learned from that Pasuk, Eish et Kodeshav lo yeh, that the Kodeshim belong to that particular Kohen when he's doing the Avodah, or maybe when he's in possession of it. And that would have then been extrapolated to here to tell us that the Kohen could have kept it. So that's why I need Achuzato to dispel that type of Limud. Now the next Mishnah. Higia Yovel, v'lo nigala. The Yovel comes, and it was never redeemed. Hakohenim nichnasim letocha. The Kohenim then take the land, those that are in the Mishmar of the Yovel, v'notnim et dameha, and they have to pay its value. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That's the view of Rabbi Yehuda over here, who we saw him yesterday's daf. And Rashi in the Gemara says that when the Kohenim have to redeem it, v'imlo ga'ala yahave Kohenim dmei chamishim shekel v'shaklila. They pay it at that fixed rate that any other party would have redeemed it at. They pay that rate, and then they're able to redeem it. There are those that suggest that it doesn't have to be that way. It might be possible that they don't get that dispensation to redeem it at the 50 shekel price. Rather, they have to pay for its fair value, because they're not really subject to the parsha of Achuzah. It's already been released from this Achuzah standing, and now it just needs to be redeemed at its fair value from Hekdesh. And since the whole purpose is not to allow Hekdesh to go out with Pijon, it would make sense to say that the Pijon that you're doing here is full value Pijon and not this special Chamishim Shekel. Shimon Omer, Nichnasim v'lo notim. Shimon says they get it, but they don't have to pay anything for it. Rabbi Eliezer, Omer, or it could be Rabbi Elazar, it's not clear. Lo Nichnasim v'lo notim. They don't get it, and they don't pay anything for it. Elenikreit Sadeh Ritushim. It's called a field that is abandoned. Ada Yovel Hasheni. And it stays in the hands of Hekdesh until the following Yovel. If it went for another 50 years without being redeemed, and now there's another Yovel, then and it's called the abandoned field. And similarly, the names would be an incentive or an advertisement for people to come in and redeem it, whether that means any party, or maybe it's an impetus to get the original owners to come in and redeem it. Ada Yovel Shlishi, until it reaches the third Yovel. Be'olam, Eina Kohenim Nichasim Letocha, the Kohenim never get a right to enter into the property until there's been a party that has redeemed it. Whether it's the original owner, whether it's a third party, someone needs to redeem it. Without that redemption, it will never be released to the Kohenim. According to Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Elazar over here, the only time that the Kohenim get it is when there's been someone who redeemed it in the interim. It was never redeemed. It's not distributed to the Kohenim. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda believe that if nobody redeemed it, the Kohenim get it. They just argue about what you have to do now. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you have to pay for it because nobody ever redeemed it. So now they need to create the pijon from Hekdesh. Whereas Rabbi Shimon says that they get it without having to pay for it. Yes, my time is the Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda's position? Gamar Kodesh, Kodesh, Mimakdish Bayit. He learns that Gzeres Shava of Kodesh, Kodesh from someone who is Makdish their house. Someone's Makdish their house. It says, Ish ki Yakdish beito Kodesh Lashem. You have to redeem the house if you're makdish it. But it uses the word kodesh lashem. In our psukim here, it says, kodesh lashem. It uses the same kodesh lashem as by the bayit that's been dedicated to Bedek HaBayit as it does by a makdish stei achuza. And therefore, the Gemara says there's a gezeira shava. Ma lahalan bidamim. Just like over there, the only way that you get your house back is by redeeming it from Hekdesh. Afghan bidamim. So to over here, the only way that the Kohenim get the field is by redeeming it or paying a pijon. Just like the Kodesh Lashem, by the bayit means now the Hekdesh owns it, and if you want it, you've got to pay for it, you've got to redeem it from Hekdesh. So too, the Kodesh Lashem by stei achuza means if you want it, you've got to pay for it, and it's even when the Kohenim are getting it. Tosfot asks over here if that is the source for the fact that the Kohenim receive it on the Yovel, and then they pay it out. It's not so clear to him that it really should go to the Kohenim. When it comes to a bayit, anybody can redeem a bayit, whether it's the owners or any third party, whether it's a Kohen or it's Yisrael. So if you're making Gzer Shava from a bayit that was Mukdash, then over here too, by Stei Achuza, maybe it should be able to go to any party that redeems it. So Tosfot says that the Pashtut of Psukim reads that if it was redeemed, or if it was not redeemed, Lo Yigael Od. There's no right of the original owner to come back in and redeem it. And therefore, there's only one party that's left, which is Vayasa David Seitoba Yovel Kosh Lashem, Kester Cherem La Kohen Tia Kuzato. It goes to the Kohanim, And the only thing we're using the Kodesh Lashem to tell us is how it goes into the possession of the Kohanim. But from the Psukim, he thinks that the Pashtut of Psukim is that it goes to the Kohen, and not that it's open to any party to come in and redeem it. Once the time period to do such a thing has elapsed, because the Yovel has come. And Tosafot says that's reinforced by the fact here that the Gemara asks the question of Maitaima, both on Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, which implies that neither of one of them is the more obvious Perush over here. Rather, each one of them is a Chidush, or has a problem with their Perush. And for that reason, the Gemara asks both what the reason of Rabbi Yehuda is and what the reason of Rabbi Shimon is. Because it is a given from the Psukim, it's going to the Kohanim. The only question is, the Gzeres Shava of Kodesh Lashem, is that going to teach you that they have to pay for it or they don't have to pay for it? And Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon both being reasonable ways to learn that, and therefore the Gemara asks, what's the reasoning behind each one of them? Because neither one of them is more logical than the other. Rabbi Shimon, Gamar, Kodesh Kodesh, Mikivsei Atzeret. He learns out Gzeres Shava from not the Bayit that you're Makdish, but rather from the Shalmei Tzibur that are brought on Shavuot. There it says Kodesh, and over here it says Kodesh. Malalan Bechinam. Just like over there, the Kohanim are entitled to the Shalmei Tzibur and the Shtei Alechem from Shavuot because they're part of the Matnot Kuhuna that they get. Afkan Bechinam. So to over here, these will be classified as Matnot Kuhuna, and they will get them without having to make any payment for them. V'Rabbi Yehuda, Nami Nelef Mikivtzei Atzeret. So why doesn't Rabbi Yehuda like the Gzer Shava of Rabbi Shimon? He says, because Danim Kochei Berek Abayit, Mikochei Berek Abayit. It makes sense to compare items that are of a similar ilk. Here we're talking about redeeming something from Hekdesh or from Berek Abayit, and over there they're speaking about redeeming a house that you're being Makdish to Berek Abayit. So these are similar cases, and it makes sense to compare them. Vein Danim Kochei Berek Abayit, Mikochei Mizbeach. But to compare Kochei Berek Abayit, where you're dedicating the monies to the upkeep of the Mikdash, versus a Shalmei Tzibur, which are a Kochei Mizbeach, they're in different worlds. And therefore, it doesn't make sense to compare them. Because Kochei Mizbeach are things that have Kedushat Aguf, because they're going on the Mizbeach itself, whereas Kochei Berek Abayit are Kedushat Damim, that are going to be used towards the upkeep of the Mikdash. And so they're really different entities. And you wouldn't want to mix and match them. It doesn't make sense to learn from Kochei Mizbeach to Kochei Berek Abayit. Makes more sense to learn from one Kochei Berek Abayit to another Kochei Berek Abayit. Rabbi Shimon Nami Nelef Mi Makdish Bayit. So why doesn't he learn like Rabbi Yehuda from a person who is Makdish, who sanctifies a house? Says the name Davar She Matana LeKohanim Mi Davar She Matana LeKohanim. Because these both of these items are Matnot Kuhuna. The Shalmei Tzibur, the Shtei Alechem, are part of the Matnot Kuhuna. So are the Shtei Achuza that were not redeemed. They're released to the Kohanim on the Yovel. That's part of, or one of, the Matnot Kuhuna. So I want to compare one Matanat Kuhuna to another Matanat Kuhuna. So I'm going to compare Shtei Achuza to Kivsei Atzeret. Ben Danim Davar Shematana LeKohanim, Davar Sheino Matana LeKohanim. But I'm not going to compare the Shtei Achuza, which is one of the Matnot Kuhuna, to a Bayit, which is not one of the gifts to the Kohanim. That goes to Hekdesh. The person pays for it. The monies go to Hekdesh and he gets it back. There, the Kohanim have no benefit or they don't get anything from it. It's not one of the Matnot Kuhuna. So over there, there's no reason to compare or correlate between the two items. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chavav Amud Aleph.